Welcome to Regulated and Relational, the bi-monthly podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. Today, Ginger and Julie have a special guest, Dr. John Balin, an attachment-focused therapist who specializes in interpersonal neurobiology and the co-author of, among other things, Brain-Based Parenting. Dr. Balin explains one of the latest concepts that is helping children to heal, the power of the pause. Let's join this important conversation.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Regulated and Relational, our podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. I'm Ginger Healy.
And I'm Julie Beam.
And we're excited to share with you from both our personal experiences and our professional knowledge what it truly means to be attachment-focused, trauma-informed, and how we can help children impacted by early childhood trauma. Today, we have a very special guest, a hero of mine, Dr. John Balin. Welcome, Dr. Balin.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, I just can't wait to dive into our conversation today and discuss Dr. Balin's groundbreaking work. But before we do that, I want to introduce him to all of our listeners. Dr. Balin received his doctorate in clinical psychology from Peabody College of Vanderbilt University in 1981. For the past 20 years, while continuing his clinical practice, he has immersed himself in the study of neuroscience and in teaching mental health practitioners about the brain. He has given numerous workshops for mental health professionals on putting the brain in therapy and has delivered keynote addresses internationally and nationally at conferences on childhood trauma and attachment. Several years ago, Dr. Balin began a collaborative relationship with Dr. Daniel Hughes, a leader in the field of attachment-focused therapy. Their first book, Brain-Based Parenting, was released by Norton Press in 2012. In 2016, their second book, The Neurobiology of Attachment-Focused Therapy, was released by Norton as well. Both books are a part of the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology. Julie and I are big fans of Dr. Balin's work, and if you remember our podcast on blocked care, then you'll also remember all of the amazing information that came from Dr. Balin and from Dr. Hughes. A concept also from Dr. Balin that we really want to dive into today is the concept of the power of the pause. And so I'm going to let Julie explain why we felt this was important and just why this concept for our listeners we felt needed to be paramount this season. And then we'll have Dr. Balin teach us all about it.
Awesome. Well, first off, it makes me feel a little bit old to hear that the Brain-Based Parenting book is over 10 years old. I'm like, oh my gosh, really? We've had it that long, which is fantastic. But last fall, when Ginger and I were at the Attach conference, we heard Jessica Sonarski, who is one of our favorite human beings, give a workshop. And in the middle, towards the very end, she made some slight comment to the power of the pause and the research that you, Dr. Balin, were doing around that. And I went, oh my gosh, that resonates so much with me personally, in that I sort of accidentally stumbled on the need to pause when I was trying to co-regulate with my daughter through some of her rocky preteen, teen years, where we were having a whole lot of dysregulated behavior. And I just felt like it was such an important concept that nobody else is really talking about. So I was like, oh, let's see if we can have Dr. Balin come talk to us about this. I think it's a secret key for so many folks. So what can you tell us when you said the power in the pause? What exactly are you talking about there?
Well, I've been fascinated for a long time, I think, by, you know, reading the brain research about the challenge getting past or getting above our very quick reactions to things, you know? So we have this sort of quick reaction, you know, lower brain circuits there for good reason that help us sense things and react very quickly, go very quickly from sensing to doing, sensing to doing. It's so important too, though, that there be times when we sense something and then hold our horses, like hit the pause button to sort of put a foot on the brake of that quick doing, that quick reaction, because a lot of times that quick, fast and furious reaction might not be the best thing to do.
That's especially true when children have been impacted by trauma, right?
Especially true when children have been impacted by trauma, because what's going on for the children is they pretty much have had to dedicate their brain development and functioning to using that fast and furious, you know, in and quickly out defense. That's the survival defense reaction system, to have to go so quickly from sensing things about other people to being ready to fight or flee or freeze. So in the brain, that's a well-oiled, you know, that's an overdeveloped circuit, actually. It's actually overdeveloped. And the circuitry, it's a whole nother brain circuit that allows us to hold our horses, to sort of hit the pause button, even when we're starting to go into that quick reaction, to have the ability to sort of put the brakes on. That, you know, it's like a ladder, it's like a gateway or a window into our higher brain that enables us to look around, take in more information before we go to output, you know, before we hit the go button. So literally the pause is like a process that allows us to hold off, just in some sense, deciding what to do. You have a little time to look around about what's really going on here. So it expands my choices. So for the kids we're talking about, that's a stepping stone to starting to be able to get above that automatic self-defensive, mindless, mistrusting reactions. It's a stepping stone towards change and recovery and healing. That's why I thought it's such an important step.
I love the idea too of empowering a child to know you can make a different choice. You can get curious about what's going on. You can change your outcome. You can be in control, because I think so often these kids feel so out of control in their environment, in their bodies even. I have heard children describe almost being hijacked by their bodies, you know, by their sensation, and not feeling in control. So just the idea of, here's what we're going to work on, and here's why we're going to work on, that feels very empowering to me.
Yes, I think it can be the beginnings of the kids learning to feel empowered by using some self-control and giving themselves that time to be curious. Curious is a beautiful word. You know, we take curiosity for granted, but when you're living totally defensively in survival mood, there's no space for curiosity. Yeah. It's not even safe to enter into curiosity, because to be curious, you take your eyes off something as a threat in order to look into it or explore it or understand it. That's a luxury of being able to feel a bit safer for a moment, to be able to get into a curious state. The pause actually is, in brain terms, the pause circuit enables or makes possible curiosity. It makes it possible to start to regain, or maybe for the first time, for the kids to gain the ability to experience what it's like to look into things with curiosity, eventually even with wonder. But at first, we're not talking about wonder. We're just talking about, hold my horses. Let me see what's really going on here.
I think this concept is so important. And one of the things when we were talking earlier that you talked about was recognizing, as the adult in this child's world, when that pause happens, because the pause might happen and then the typical habitual reaction might happen on top of that pause. Like at first there's a hesitation, but then maybe, you know, that normal reaction that they are giving, that we don't want them to give, you know, happens anyway. But recognizing that pause as a successful step forward is huge, right?
Really huge, Julie. That's why we would talk a little bit. This has been our pre-talk. You know, I was telling you about it. I learned so much recently from a girl I was working with, consulting with. She's about 13 years old. And I could see that when she was talking with her adoptive father, that she would start to go into the pause, which as you're beginning the pause, it's actually like a freeze, like a deer in the headlights. It's not actually the fear, but it's holding back the flight and fear and fight response. As you start to do that, you get quiet. Mm-hmm. You don't have your words at first when you go into the pause. And I could see when we had some sessions together that her dad, he was on eggshells with her. He thought the pause was still a negative thing, mm-hmm. that she wasn't talking. So he might say, use your words, speak up. And she would then maybe be even more likely just to go into defense. She'd lose the pause and just do the defending. You know, because I was thinking more about the pause and the value of it, I was able to help him to see that if he could just say something like to me, you know, honey, I really want to hear what you have to say. Can you speak up a little bit? It would help her to stay with the pause and come out of the pause, moving towards him, you know, moving more towards the choice to engage with him rather than the choice to disengage and defend against him. I saw that when he was able to, you know, value the pause and tolerate her being quiet for a little while as she wrestled with herself in the pause, that was so valuable, so helpful to her.
And then I shared with you sort of the reverse situation in that as the adult caretaker, I found this power in the pause for my own brain so that I didn't dysregulate in the face of my dysregulated daughter. One time in particular, we were in a pretty semi-public situation. She was in a group therapy session and she dysregulated and she ran out of that room, didn't run out of the building, but ran out of that room and was, you know, running around the facility in this dysregulated state. And I could hear her. So I asked permission at the reception desk to go to her. And when I got to her, my brain was spinning, you know, in terms of, you know, what could happen, like all the negative things that could happen, all the negative things that could happen next. And so I was able to, in that moment, pause, and I literally just kind of slid down the wall next to her. She was in the corner of a hallway and didn't say anything for what felt like 100 years to me. In part because I couldn't, because I was trying to, you know, keep my cognitive brain online, right? I was trying to think this problem through, but I was feeling all the emotion of how bad this could be. And that was co-regulating to her. I could watch her regulation come down. She met me in that silence, if that makes sense. And I was like, oh, this is a tool. I mean, this thing that I just did almost by accident, you know, like trying to keep my own thinking brain online, it works for me and it works for her.
Yeah, no, that's lovely, Julie. It makes me think of syncing up in the pause state. You know, you're syncing with each other in silence for a little while. Your ability to be with her without having to push at her, make her talk, or make her shift what she was doing and just let her be where she was while in the pause was very co-regulating.
And I was probably at that point, because of our relationship, was the only person who would have been able to do that in that moment. You know, it was something I definitely learned from. Like when I thought back through it, I was like, oh my gosh. So when Jessica said those words, power of the pause, it took me right to that second, right to that memory. And I was like, that was when I learned that if I can pause, I'm really helping the situation a lot. Talk to us a little bit about that brain science, because I'm a brain geek. I love hearing this, but also because I know you're so well versed in it, what is happening in your brain during the pause?
Well, you know, a lot of people these days know something about the amygdala, for example, you know, the famous amygdala, which I always want to say you have two of them, because when people hear about the amygdala, they think it's one thing in the middle of your brain. So you have one on each side of your brain. But anyway, you know, the reason the amygdala is so fascinating and intriguing is it's one of those first places in the brain that starts us having reactions to things. Because the amygdala, in about a tenth of a second, really less, can start to, you know, sort of sort out or determine if something is a safe or a threat. So the reason we have an amygdala and that we inherited that, the amygdala has been around for way longer than humans. It's a very old thing. You know, the value of the amygdala is that it can so quickly start to do things to try to help us avoid harm. But if the amygdala keeps running the show in our brains, if we continue to mostly be using our amygdala to make decisions, so to speak, about, you know, what to get close to and what to stay away from, we won't be using some of our higher brain powers and some of our smarter ways to figure out what's what and what's safe and what isn't. And we won't be learning much. You know, if you're just reacting to things from your amygdala, it's hard to learn new things. We have to upshift. We have to upshift in our brain. And the amygdala, fortunately, it is like a hub. It's connected to many different parts of the brain, not just to the lower fight, flight, and freeze reaction. So the pause is really opening up a brain circuit that connects a higher region in the brain. For the people who want to be really fancy out there, it's called your cingulate. If you want to be really nerdy, Julia Ginger, it's called your dorsal anterior cingulate cortex. It's a region up above, you know, sort of underneath your big outer brain at the top. The cingulate is underneath it. And there's a part of it that's very strongly connected to your amygdala. But it can receive opinions from your amygdala, but it can send opinions back down to your amygdala, so to speak. Okay. And that's for the pause window. So when you activate that circuit where your amygdala is talking to that part of your cingulate is listening. The cingulate then allows you to hold your horses, amygdala, wait, don't hit the go button on fighting and fleeing and freezing, hold it off. And then that part of the brain in the cingulate can ask other parts of the brain, what do we know about this? What's going on here? It even gives you time to recognize that other person in the room who you're reacting to, because it takes about 0.3 seconds to recognize your adoptive mother or father, to actually consciously know who you're reacting to.
That this is not somebody from your past.
That's right. Your amygdala does not initially make that distinction. It reacts to something like the facial expression or tone of voice or gestures that other person's making, not to a conscious perception of who you're even with. That takes that 0.3 seconds. You got to give your brain longer to do that.
And I think that's a really important concept, because oftentimes as a parent, I can say that for whatever reason, that pause was a trigger for me or was bothering me, or I didn't appreciate it or understand it. And understand that it's not personal. What the child is doing, what the child is reacting to, what's going on is not about me. Like, I have to just tamp that down and attune to that child and what's going on in the moment. That's been hard for me.
Oh, no, that's beautiful though, Jim. If you think about the beauty of the parent pause, it helps me as a parent get above this is personal. And in that moment, I might even not almost be recognizing who I'm dealing with. When it's amygdala to amygdala interactions, your amygdala, in a sense, everything's personal. It's almost the job of the amygdala to start to figure out at first, you know, is this personal? And if so, what do I need to quickly do about it? So getting above it's personal is the beauty of the pause for the parent pause. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sometimes if I make a brain picture of it, I show that when I do the parent pause, I move my child from one place of my brain down in my amygdala, higher up into my brain, where I can be aware of my child, or I can even remember things about my child's history, or I can have some mind sight rather than just almost automatic blind sight, you know, when I'm just reacting.
That is so powerful. I mean, the concept of the two, I mean, we were talking about the child, but we're also, of course, talking about the adult, because co-regulation, you can't have one without the other. And healing the child, we can't have one without the other. It takes both of our regulated, you know, nervous systems to heal, but to get there is a whole other thing, you know. Mm-hmm. And so being in sync, you talked about that within your stories. Yeah. Both of those stories you gave, I heard attunement, I heard empathy, and of course, I heard that pause that was intertwined with all of it.
That's a great way to start thinking about it. So relationally, dyadically, yeah. So Julie, when you joined your daughter Pause to Pause, you were going first. That's, I often say to parents, you know, it might not feel fair, but you've got the adult brain.
Right. Hopefully yeah. More mature and able to hold it together.
You have more power, yeah. Even than children who haven't been through any kind of, you know, developmental stress or trauma. You still, as a parent, you've got the adult brain to work with. Well, that circuit I'm talking about, you know, it's much more likely to be usable and developed in an adult brain. It's a lot harder for kids to even hit the pause button and hold their horses. You might remember the famous cookie test or donut test or whatever it was. You know, give four-year-olds the task of don't eat this cookie until I come back, I'll give you two. And the, you know, you watch them trying to do the pause.
They most of them can't do that.
It's like a motor thing. You know, they can't just do it with their mind, so to speak. They have to do it with their bodies. They have to hold themselves back because it's so much more work to do the pause when you're little. Mm-hmm. So we have to go first. We have to be the proactive pausers and practice it.
We know about a brain is the more you practice something, the better you, I mean, it's just like everything else in our physical body. Yeah. The more you practice it, the better you get at it.
Better you get. And I would just say all this emphasis, we talk about mindfulness so much. Well, practicing mindfulness is actually practicing the pause, actually practicing using that window, you know, where you focus on your breathing and then your mind wanders to something that might be troubling or, you know, a worry. You have to pause to not go down that rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. So that's actually strengthening the pause system.
So. That makes so much sense. Just that ability to stay present, that can be very hard. And to put away distractions and to be in the moment. I loved what you said, how you kind of coached the father of words to say and how to honor that pause and create safety for her struggle. I thought that was a beautiful illustration because it's hard. And so for you to be able to talk to this daughter and this father and say, here's what's going on. Why don't you try this? I found that very moving, you know.
Well, moving is the word. I have to be in touch with how hard it is as a caregiver, as a parent, when you're trying to care for and stay loving and get close to someone who's snapping at you, someone who's not able yet to trust you, and you don't have that give and take and that lovely reciprocity. You're not getting smiled at and giggled, and you know, you don't have that beautiful shared social reward system going on. You know, it's really hard. I have to pause sometimes because it's easier for me to get upset with the big person. I can go into a little bit of block care with the big people, you know, because I, you know, I feel protective towards the little people. Well, I have to use my pause as a therapist too, and use that pause to get my compassion hat on and remember how hard it is. And I could do that with this man, you know. He's actually came from the military, but now he's becoming a nurse. He's like on a journey, you know. I knew he had a big heart, but I knew he was on eggshells with this girl. And I had to pause to get my compassion on, you know. Then I could say to him something like, Jim, you know, I know you're trying to connect. If you could do such and such, maybe you'd help her to move towards you rather than clamor. And I actually told him about the pause and how she was struggling to control herself rather than bite his head off. That was a good thing.
Yeah. No, I love that. And I love that you point that out, to take the pause to get your compassion hat on, because I'm thinking about all of our listeners, some of which are not just caregivers. Some are educators who are feeling that way about the child's parent or caregiver. Some are caregivers who are feeling that way about the child's teacher. We could use this pause skill to get our compassion hats on in so many ways, right? and recognize that it's a human brain thing. I mean, this isn't just something that people are doing intentionally, you know, to not be able to hold their horses, to sort of fly off in that way.
Right.
It's a brain and body reaction. You know, we, each one of us has to learn to control.
Yes, true. And, you know, those brain body reactions, they can just run our show. But one of the powers we have is the power to set a goal. If we can set a goal to have some intention of working on our ability to do the pause, you know, and strengthen the pause, you know, I can be self-revelatory enough to admit that I can sometimes be a bit impatient, even with loved ones.
I can't imagine that from you.
No, I know you can't. I'm being so kind and gentle, but I've been married for 56 years to a woman who's put up with some of my impatience, you know. And the more I'm on the move, the quicker I want to get something said and heard and understood and move on.
I hear you.
So I set my intentions. I love learning about my own pause, and, you know, it helps to set some intentions to work on patience, pause to be patient. So I get to work on that every day.
I think we all do. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We all have that opportunity. I love the idea of being intentional about this. Can you give us other ideas of how to strengthen this within our children and ourselves?
Yeah. I think the main take home about that, Ginger, I mean, one of the biggest reasons, of course, is that the grown-ups need to go first. We have more power to set intentions. Our frontal lobe allows us to do things in a more purposeful, goal-directed way in life. That's part of that beautiful developmental maturation of our brains. Is the last part of our brains to mature is the part that gives us that power to do something with intention and to set a goal and then persevere pursuing that goal. So with kids, I think we have to help them to be motivated to work on a goal like that. We can do it with games. When kids play games like red light, green light, the things where you have to actually practice holding back, go, stop, mm-hmm. that's actually using that pause circuit. So there's some, I think, playful ways to work at that in addition to sort of more, you know, serious adult ways where we might say that I'm going to work on my patience. I'm going to strengthen that pause. I'm going to practice my meditation and my mindfulness.
Right. No, I think that's great.
So there are a lot of ways to do it, I think.
So when we talked earlier, you said something. I wrote it down because it struck me and we didn't really explore it. I'm going to read it back to you now because it's kind of the opposite of what we, a lot of times we talk about. The way to make sure that we're promoting felt safety is to be predictable and have a routine and all of those kinds of things. And we talk to educators about the importance of routines and rituals and those. But you said, since the brain is looking for novelty, being unexpectedly paceful is what you were talking about. Can you talk about what you mean by unexpectedly paceful? Our audience knows a little bit about pace, but not a lot. So that struck me. I thought, well, I think I get it, but I would love to hear you talk about that.
One of the things I was intrigued to learn about in reading the brain science, you know, I don't do the brain science, by the way, I read it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I learned was that our brain is like a prediction machine, you know. Mm-hmm. We use the past to predict what's happening next, and we do it automatically. We anticipate. So what are kids with blocked trust predict? They predict that they're going to get negative responses from other people. They don't wait to see what the response is. Our brain predicts what's coming and we're prepared for it before it gets there, right? So if we keep responding to kids in the way that they expect us to do, you know, if we're defensive when they're defensive, then it's a no-brainer for the kids. We're meeting their expectations. There's nothing new to learn. There's no wake-up call. Their brain doesn't shift into a higher state of attention because there's nothing new. There's nothing new to pay attention to. So one of the ways to help these kids recover from that mindless defensiveness is the element of surprise, the good surprise.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so the good surprise would be responding in some kind of positive way to their defensiveness. The greatest moments to create that surprise are when, in some ways, when they're at their most defensive. You know, Julie, you probably surprised your daughter when you went to be with her and you went into your pause and you were just with her. There was some element of surprise. So one of the things I learned was when something unexpected happens, we get an error signal in our brains. I love that. Error signal is like a, uh-oh, that didn't go the way I expected. What I need to do, I need to pay attention. Something's happening here that it was not predicted. And that's the wake-up call to pay attention to what's going on rather than just keep, you know, going on and on and on mindlessly having my expectations met, nothing new to learn. See how that works. So there's a beautiful thing that happens. We get an error signal. We I love the chemistry. We actually get a spurt of dopamine down in our brain, up into that brain circuit. And you know what it does? It turns on the pause window.
That's cool.
You think about it. There's the something strange going on here. It brings me to the present. I have to pay attention to what's happening rather than just continuing to predict mindlessly what's going to happen to me with other people. So particularly early on, you know, the power of that paceful, unexpectedly compassionate or understanding or curiosity. What's going on with you, Mary? You had such a strong reaction to that. All the elements of pace, the playfulness, acceptance, curiosity, and every letter of it, you know, is potential for surprise. So pacing the defensive brain, if it creates the error signal, opens the pause window.
I love that. We've talked a lot on this podcast about that pace model because we find it so effective and so grounded in neuroscience and everything that really works for kids. And so that's really, I love a practical reminder and use for it because it kind of goes back to that being intentional too, like making space, you know, for this, holding space for the pause, you know, giving it words and creating this moment of this is what we're doing right now. You know, those new neural pathways that respond so well to patterns that we're shifting the patterns so that they can respond in a better.
And I think it's something we can think about with our kids and also in all kinds of other relationships where maybe we're in, like we might be in a rut. You know, my brain is expecting your brain to do X and, you know, right back at inserting that novelty. I mean, that's such a powerful thing. You know, that does turn on those circuits that make you have to go,
Well, you know, you make me think, so this could be useful in couples therapy, not just in parenting.
Exactly.
Part of the way to help couples get out of ruts is to learn to be more surprising to each other in positive ways.
Exactly.
There's so much to learn about each other, you know, even after 56 years of marriage, I learned usually learn something a little new every day. If I can use my pause window, you know, and create a little surprise or have that surprise experience. So yeah, I love that, Julie, in any relationship, particularly an ongoing relationship. If we stop doing those surprises where it's getting stale and we think we know everything and we don't.
It's a good exercise. Now, the PACE model has been wonderful for our family in particular, for me in particular, because I'm not the most playful person. And if I practice that play, it goes so well for me and everybody around me.
Well, so you're laughing, so you're getting better at it.
Yeah, it's a shift, right? You can feel that shift inside of, you know, moving from one emotion to another. I love that, you know, it's like a sigh. It just feels different.
Yeah, the shift.
Yeah. That's a big thing we talk to parents and teachers about is making that shift. And I love that you've said repeatedly during our conversation today that the big people's brains need to go first in that.
Yeah.
And it's hard. I mean, that means the big people also need to do their own work and take care of themselves so that they're able to get there. It is the way is that the big people's brains have to go first. Believe it or not, we're tight on time. And believe it or not, I opened your book, Brain-Based Parenting, and it fell open to this quote today. I had it marked on another thing about blocked care, but it fell open to this quote. And I thought, oh, this is very applicable to what we're talking about right now. So I'm going to read you back to you. Here it goes. The more we are able to stay open to our experiences as a parent, the better our brains get at linking emotional and cognitive processes, at integrating affective and reflective functions. It's not an exaggeration to say that the biggest challenge for us as parents is to regulate our emotions, to feel the intensity of the full range of human feelings without breaking the connection with or hurting our children. I was kind of mic drop after that.
Wow. Actually said that?
Page 143.
All right. I'm going to look back. Thank you for that.
It was such truth. You know, I was like, wow, I need to make sure that, you know, that our listeners hear that today as well, that it's not about getting rid of our emotions in that pause. It's about holding our emotion. I mean, we get to have our emotions and should have our full range of emotions, but it's what we do with it in the moment.
We do with them, Julie. Yeah, I think mental health is feeling safe with the full range of our human mammalian emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have a phobia about any one of those emotions. We can experience all of them safely enough that we don't have to flip our lids.
I love that. Yeah, those emotions are useful and purposeful and there for a reason. So
yes,
comfortable in the uncomfortable, and you know, that regulated adult can regulate a child, but a dysregulated adult cannot.
All of it. There's, all of it has a place.
Well, thank you. Dr. Balin, wow. This was so much fun. Maybe we should do this again sometime.
Well, I'd be glad to come back. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
It's been great. Yeah. And just honing in on this one little moment of pause and the importance of it. Thanks to the folks that are listening out there, and we'll catch you all next episode.
This has been another episode of Regulated and Relational. Join us next time when Bill Z, an ATN board member and trauma-informed special education attorney, will be in the studio to discuss trauma-informed special education and how to advocate for changes that make systems trauma-responsive. A special thanks to Lorraine Schneider, our editor, and Joe Kramer for donating our music. For more information about the Attachment and Trauma Network, visit our website at attachtrauma.org. Show notes and upcoming episodes will be available on our website and through anchor.fm. I'm Danny Pankratz. Thanks for listening.